Hello and welcome back. I am Ben Merkel. I'm president of New St. Andrews College, and today I am joined by senior fellow of philosophy, Dr. Mitchell P. Stokes.
Good to be here. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, thanks for joining me, Mitch. We are here to talk about Mitch as a math teacher. So let's just dive right into this question of math and math's role in a place like New St. Andrews, where we're a liberal arts college. How does math fit into a liberal arts education?
Yeah, that's a good question. In fact, that's probably one of the most difficult questions that we've, at least as a classical Christian ed movement, have had to deal with. It's kind of hard to see how 1 + 1 = 2 is distinctly Christian, for one thing, and then how you would teach that from a classical perspective.
Yeah, how does that differ from how you teach it anywhere else?
Yeah, right. It seems like, and so I think this has been, over the last couple of decades, this has been one of those questions that we've really had a hard time answering. And, there are a couple of ways that I've tried to answer this. One is to look at the nature of liberal arts historically. And what you find is that the liberal arts, you know, there's seven liberal arts, and kind of astonishingly, 4/7 of them, there's some math there, 4/7 of them are mathematics. They're mathematical disciplines. And this is all due to Plato. Notice what I did there. I totally was able to tie that into classical ed.
Wow. Yeah. Well done. Yeah. Well done. Yeah. Right. Okay.
So, and here's one of the things that you discover studying math, philosophy, and science, all three of those disciplines, is that they really, the nature of those disciplines as they've come down to us through the, at least in the Western, in Western culture, is we're basically, we can find their fount, the fount of them, the font of the headwaters at Plato. And Plato was, he was a Pythagorean. So really you can start the whole thing with Pythagoras. Now normally we think, oh gosh, you know, this is like this is a liberal arts person's nightmare. You know, to say, you know, here's where we're going to find the core of the liberal arts. We're going to go back to Pythagoras.
Right.
Because Everyone thinks of, you know, the Pythagorean theorem, and that's about it when it comes to Pythagoras. But it's but this notion of Pythagoreanism could be summed up in this notion: the cosmos is mathematical, so the universe is mathematical, and there's more to life, more to humans than just our bodies. So there's two prong thing, and those fit together. So Pythagoras, the Pythagoreans, actually we don't know if Pythagoras was a real individual, but we do know that there are Pythagoreans. And the soul was the most important part of a human. And in order to perfect that soul, so it was kind of a sanctification process, in order to perfect that soul, the Pythagoreans said that you should study mathematics to purify the soul.
Story problems.
Yeah. Oh. and so you're studying mathematics, and you're also, because the cosmos is mathematical, your soul is becoming more like the cosmos. So you have these two weird sorts of notions about mathematics and the nature of reality. And if that would have died with the Pythagoreans, we never would have heard about him. But they show up in the Plato's Republic.
Right.
Okay. The way he trains the philosopher kings, the ideal way to train the leaders of the city-state is through this, partly through the study of the liberal arts, and it turns out that the liberal arts are, in addition to the trivium, are the quadrivium. So you have astronomy, geometry, harmony or music, and arithmetic.
Okay.
And so
plays and arithmetic, is that specifically what form of math is that?
Yeah, and back when well, it was actually pretty complicated even at the time of Plato. But if you think of arithmetic, it's just the manipulation of numbers.
Okay.
So lots of, you know, 1 + 1 = 2 would fall under the arithmetic sort of thing, but it gets advanced fairly quickly.
And astronomy and music were essentially other forms of math as
well. Yeah, so exactly. And so you have this fourfold, what's called the quadrivium, is just the Pythagorean or Platonic division of mathematics.
Okay.
And that was really, that formed the basis of, you know, it's kind of like the liberal arts graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, you know, you study the trivium and then you go on to study the quadrivium. And it's fascinating how Plato sets the agenda for the rest of Western history when it comes to this notion of a mathematical cosmos,
mm-hmm,
and the use of the liberal arts.
So what role then does you're teaching at a classical Christian liberal arts college, and you're describing this classical side where you've got the roots in this pagan Greek philosopher.
Right.
What role does that then have inside a Christian liberal arts program, and how do you bring those together?
Right. Yeah. And I think this is one of the things that we have to be careful of. I think classical Christian ed is starting there. The educators are starting to see that Pythagoreanism and the quadrivium and all of that is very important, but then it's like, okay, well, what do you do with that? Well, this notion of Pythagoreanism, in fact, goes all the way through Western culture, through the scientific revolution. So the scientific revolution of the 1600s is basically this resurgence of the Pythagorean Platonic vision that we can describe the universe mathematically. So you get Copernicus and Galileo saying, hey, look, let's do this stuff mathematically. And everyone, you know, it becomes, the culmination of which becomes Isaac Newton's mathematical physics. Now, most of those folks, if not all of the folks in the scientific revolution, were Christians. And so they're thinking in terms of this notion of design. I mean, they're specifically calling it Pythagoreanism or Neoplatonism, and they're very aware of that. At the same time, they're very conscious of this notion of a mathematical cosmos or universe and us being able to understand it mathematically as a design argument. So it's like, look, God has made the universe according to these mathematical principles, and he's given humans the ability to understand it in terms of their reason. I mean, like, the scientific revolution, the Christians and the scientific revolution, that was not lost on them. They were very, very conscious about God being a central reason or presupposition or foundation for the whole scientific endeavor.
It seems like what you're describing here is something that's very similar that happened on a theological end with Sola Scriptura, where it's, he gave us the Bible, so dig in and read, and that causes them to question certain things that the Catholic Church is teaching. And then you're describing something that seems parallel, where it's, look, he gave us math and minds to understand it. And at the same time, people are diving in and starting to question some of the preceding models that they've been told.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And that's, you have the scientific revolution setting this foundation on this notion of design. And science today, particularly physics, I mean, this is Werner Heisenberg, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, one of the founders of quantum mechanics, I think it was him, said that nature has, or Plato has been vindicated by contemporary physics. Like, this is just, it's amazing how this could have happened. And you have another Nobel laureate in physics, Eugene Wigner, talking about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. It's like, look, there's no way we should be able to figure out about the subatomic world that's far beyond sense perception. So if you're, on an evolutionary story, if you're running around the savannah, plains of the savannah, and you're trying not to get killed, quarks don't have any bearing on your faculties at all and your cognitive abilities. And so
there's no reason you should be able to dig down and understand them and make sense of them.
Exactly. And so this is one of the, and so what Wigner says, this unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, how do you account for this? And if anyone would know, it's the founders of quantum mechanics, how amazing this is. And so this notion of design now, and I think this is a project that I'm currently working on, is kind of a challenge to the Darwinian view based on this application of mathematics and physics.
Wow. And so to step into your classroom for a moment, what are you then covering over the course of the year in your classroom? How do you bring what you just described into your classroom?
Yeah, good. So we're for the folks listening, we're on basically a quarter. So we have four terms throughout the year, two terms being equivalent to a semester. And so I break it into terms. So this first term, which we're in actually now, I talk about this Pythagorean Platonic foundation of mathematics. So we talk a lot about Plato and some of the problems that arose and gave rise to certain crises and revolutions in philosophy and math. Second term, we focus on the scientific revolution. And so we look at the innovations there, talking about Galileo and Newton. And we also talk about the Galileo affair and how that got him into hot water. So we talk about the scientific revolution. But then what we find in that second term is that Isaac Newton, had to invent the calculus in order to really fulfill this Platonic Pythagorean vision. He had to actually invent new math in order to describe moving objects, that was the calculus. Right. So he invents calculus. Well, what I want the students to see, rather than just tell them about it, mm-hmm. I want them to see how it works. And so the third term, what I do is I actually, in 8 weeks, run through and teach them calculus. And this is the magical part, or one of the magical parts, is I've done this year after year, or at least, how about this? I've repeated this enough to know that it really works, is that you can actually take liberal arts students who are fearful of even algebra and teach them the fundamentals of calculus. And we can talk about how I do that and all of that some other time, but it's actually, we can do that so they can see how it's done. So that third term, they're learning calculus. And then the fourth term, we talk about these post-scientific revolution crises in mathematics that has led to crises in modernism and postmodernism. And so we talk about that. And these mostly occurred, these revolutions, in the 19th century. So we finish the term talking about that, and then the developments of quantum mechanics and general relativity in the 20th century.
So in what sense then is this, this isn't your typical math class, right?
Right.
I mean, kids
right.
aren't showing up with a calculator and scratch paper and cranking out problems. In what sense is it a math class?
Yeah.
Well, I'll let you answer that, but then I'd also like to ask, in what sense is this the thing that STEM is missing? It seems like you're supplying something that's not really out there.
Yeah, no, this is, coming from my background is engineering initially. So I used to work as an engineer. So I have a master's degree in mechanical engineering. So I've done enough math to know how math is taught. I know how I thought about math. But then studying philosophy afterwards and the philosophy of science and math, I realized what I was missing. And so you're right. It's not a typical math course. And one of the things that we forget is a lot of it's not just the story of how mathematics was developed, but the centrality of it to Western culture. And not just, and I don't want to just tell students, hey guys, math is important, just so you know. I want them to see in very specific, concrete ways how it was important in all of these realms, in philosophy and science and math. And then I want them to actually do, so they do get to do math. But I want them to also see how that fits into the larger picture. I mean, you really can teach the history of Western philosophy and science through this story. And so that's what I want to do. I want them to see the big picture, and I want them to see why they think the way they do, why other people, maybe an atheistic worldview, why those folks would think the way they do. And I want them to put it into context, then also bring it, you know, I don't want to leave them in history. I want them to see, well, how should we think about it now? And we should, I mean, Christians more than anyone, any other folks, should be so enthusiastic about science, should be so enthusiastic about physics. It's just remarkable the kinds of things that humans can do that if you're not thinking about it, you can take it for granted. But then if you stop and think about it for just a moment, it's such evidence for design.
Right.
And it's so central to our culture too.
And you said you came from the STEM world, engineering, and all of that.
Yeah.
Do you think that what you're describing here, is this something that is missing on that side?
I do. It would be wonderful if all the STEM folks could, I'd love for them to take this course. I mean, I'd love, because this is what I wish I would have known. It would have put everything into context. So you're not just going through recipes, you're not just following, you know, you just don't have these natural laws thrown at you or equations, and you see a much bigger picture. And so you can appreciate the enormous amount of work that went into coming up with these, how magical it really is that we could discern some of these secrets of the universe using this really arcane kind of symbolism. And it's really, the sense of wonder is just lost. And this isn't just something that I think that STEM folks should have. I think if someone's not going into STEM, and that's a lot of our students, I think this is crucial for them to understand.
Well, thanks very much, Mitch. I appreciate that. And we are going to come back again next week with Mitch to discuss his work on apologetics. Thank you.
I'm a 2009 graduate of New St. Andrews College, and I'm a commercial property manager.
Three kids at Logos, one at home still, and I do flowers on the side out of our house. When you have these little people that you're responsible to shepherd, you realize I need to know what I'm talking about because they need to have a firm foundation and they need deep roots so that they don't get blown over and that they're ready to stand up for the truth.
I am a programmer. The language aspect of NSA is a fantastic preparation for any sort of programming.
I'm a real estate broker here in town. I think absolutely the perfect education for being in sales of really any kind.
I actually put it to a lot of great use when I was working in the political realm.
I am a pastor in Central Coast, California. Whatever vocation you take, it'll make you take that seriously because you're seeing it through the lens of the sovereignty and lordship of Christ.
For more information, visit us online at nsa.edu.